I'm Mark Gagan, and you're listening to the Voice of Insurance podcast, produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling an enterprise view of exposure. Today's guests are the executives behind the fast-growing specialist aviation broker startup, Peak Risk Partners. In a very short space of time, Philips Mage, CEO, and Marcel Chad, president, have put Peak on the front pages of the trade press with some eye-popping blue-chip household name client wins. In a time of seemingly permanent consolidation and the homogenisation of so much of the intermediary market, theirs is a story that I think will inspire many brokers. People, connections, specialist knowledge and expertise, and an ultra-client-focused approach are clearly still incredibly important. Listen on for the secrets of their early successes and what drives their business, an honest assessment of the impending acquisition of their parent company, Corient Global, by Ardonagh, and a frank analysis of the state of the aviation market. Enjoy the podcast.
Hi, I'm Rick J. Lindsay, Chairman and CEO of Claims Direct Access, otherwise known as CDA. We all read about the claims nightmares in the United States of America, social inflation, nuclear verdicts, and the sky is falling. Hardly a day goes by without the news of reserve strengthening at major carriers. However, it's not all bad news. In the United States of America, we have the best legal system in the world, which allows you to fight frivolous claims and litigation and come out on top. In this kind of environment, you must get smarter about how you handle your claims and who your partners are. You have to move fast and be robust. CDA has been handling claims for over 40 years nationwide and has a team of 46 claims professionals, including 12 highly skilled attorneys and litigators. We have handled cases for major Lloyd's syndicates since 1994, as well as U.S.-based major carriers, and have closed over 70,000 claims since 1994 nationwide. Not settling frivolous litigations is a must. CDA claim service means going the extra mile, handling claims quickly and vigorously with a proactive approach. Why not get in contact now to see how CDA can do the same amazing work for you and your partners that they do for me every day? Visit www.claimsdirectaccess.com today.
Phil and Marcel, thank you so much for giving up some time. You must be incredibly busy. It's great to be physically in your new offices. I wanted to catch up with you again because you're a fast-moving business. You're growing really, really fast. And when we first met, you just started. And that was back in the last day in January 2020, a huge amount has happened since then. Back then you said you had 31 staff. So why don't you just bring us up to date on where you are in your growth plan?
Well, Mark, first of all, welcome to the Peak office. It's great to see you. It's amazing that it's 15, 16 months since we met. And of course, as the world starts to get back to some normality, the face-to-face element continues to be an important balance with the new world order of however we're going to organise ourselves in terms of working practices. I guess when Marcel and I were socialising and then planning the Peak business, we thought about things that would go well and we thought about things that might not go so well individually and for the collective, but none of us thought about a pandemic and the impact that that would have on us. So roll on 15 months. We're really proud of what we've achieved. We've onboarded more colleagues, many of them remotely. So we're up to over 50 people globally today. We've opened an operation in France with Anlaw Rosenwald, which was an important moment for us from a distribution standpoint, but also from a Brexit solution standpoint. And actually, only last week, we were able to get some of the team in London together virtually in a slightly more relaxed environment than our office, which was actually an important thing for us to do. In the meantime, we're up to over 50 customers. I can't remember quite how many policies, but well over 100. And so the build out has been, I think, significant despite a very significant headwind. We continue to evolve. And I think that in the short aftermath of going into lockdown in the middle of March, we looked at our strategy and whether we needed to pivot the strategy somewhat. We were really setting ourselves up to be a large and complex retail broker. That's still absolutely core to what we are setting out to do in our proposition. But we've also looked at wholesale relationships as we develop our network.
You're absolutely right to allude to the fact that
2020 was the year when any best laid plans would have gone astray. You've got a perfectly good excuse for having completely pivoted and gone back to your backers and said, well, we need a year off from all this. But how has it gone? As far as I think, anecdotally, it looks like things have been going extremely well with some really big client wins.
Well, Mark, I think COVID introduced the concept of a double-edged sword. Clearly, at a time when we wanted to travel the world, visit prospects, we were precluded from doing so. But indeed, so were our competitors. So as we thought about our strategies, and we've been very active in terms of our online engagement and media, we found that actually the clients were actually very receptive to talking to us because they were themselves facing the challenges introduced by COVID, not least of all to the aviation industry. So it has opened up opportunities to engage with clients that we would not otherwise have expected. And so I think the lesson learned is things that you thought might happen didn't, and things that we didn't expect have. And in general, as you've alluded, it's been very positive. And certainly our client wins, some notable recent wins, have reinforced that, some of which have occurred since the announcement of Ardonagh acquiring Corent, which I'm sure you're going to touch on in a while.
So now with the scorecard, sort of when you were starting the business, where are you against that plan? Obviously, I understand the plan must have changed 20 times since then, but where are you against that original plan in terms of feeling where you are with sort of 50 staff and the sort of income that you're generating now?
Well, of course, we've been slowed down to some extent because of the environment that we've operated in. And we've looked at the business across the segments, across the geographies. And so I think we acknowledge the mountain to climb was a bit steeper in these early days. But in concert with our investor and the management at Corent, we're comfortable on where we are today. We see great aspiration for the future. We've got shared aspiration in terms of wanting to be market leading. We've got shared aspiration around the proposition and not just, I think I referred to it previously as turning up and doing the same things. Of course, we've got to do the core transactional stuff incredibly well. But at the same time, I think that our offering is different and also thoughtful around the environment that the clients are operating in, which is in many cases distressed.
I think also we slowed down on some of our hiring, not through absence of ambition, just a reality of not being able to see people, meet people. Some of the talent that we know well, it's still about, it's a people business and it's about having a face-to-face conversation. So I think that our ambitions to attract talent continue, but we also recognise that talent has choices. And there's a lot going on in the industry at the moment, not least all the aviation industry with some of the issues, complications introduced by the Willis-Aon merger. So we see opportunities ahead of us. I think talent is cautious and we're equally cautious about making sure there's a good match for prospective talent that we're looking to bring into our business.
It reminds me, when we last spoke, I was listening back to the first episode we did over a year ago. You'd said one of the nice things about starting Peak was having the luxury of being able to hire the talent that you wanted, as opposed to having to learn to live with the talent that you'd inherited at your bigger teams, at bigger brokers. How's it gone in terms of prizing away some of that talent? You're saying your talent is sometimes cautious.
I've got a personal view that, again, talent has choices, but people leave their current employers because they want to, either because they're unhappy with the circumstance they're in, you know, how they're rewarded, how they're recognised, who they report to, or perhaps sometimes because they can't get to do what they really want, where they want to take their career next. So if you can find that double match, that people are unhappy and actually that aspirationally we can offer them that opportunity and to fulfil their ambitions, then you've got the perfect storm. If people don't want to leave, then sometimes they change their minds or they don't convert. So again, you know, we're very thoughtful about looking for a win-win. We've been in this business now. I've been here 2 years, Philip a little less. We came here to be here for a long time and to build a business over multiple years to serve the clients that we are now winning. And with that, we want long-term talent that really wants to be part of that organisation.
Just to add to that, I think everyone individually has had their own journey through COVID and what that's meant for them individually, privately, domestically, and corporately, professionally. So I think in the early phase, there were a lot of individuals that were sort of using it as an opportunity to just take stock because of the uncertainty. And I'm not saying that being critical, I think that's just the reality of the situation. But as Marcel has said, you know, we are looking very much at what's the right type of person with their skill set to the roles that we're looking to fulfill. And actually, we've adapted some of the thinking around that, different needs for the business because of where we are and what we've learned, going into this, we might have had a sort of idea of what the organisation would look like before we turned up or day one. And I think the organisation, in terms of the shape, the expertise, the knowledge and know-how, is a little bit different just because of the mix of our business.
I suppose it's just a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're talking to some talent at one, you know, at a different broker or somewhere, and if they don't come, well, it obviously couldn't have worked out anyway, because they're not the right sort of person. If they're not going to, you need the sort of people who are going to make that leap. And if they don't make the leap, clearly they weren't the right sort of person to make a leap anyway. So
I always take the view, there's no hard feelings. If someone doesn't want to come and work with us, then ultimately that's the decision they have to make. They have to do what's right for them, and we have to do what's right for us. And it's about finding that middle ground.
You've got to acknowledge that they are probably taking a risk, or at least in their mind.
Yeah, I think there's risk with everything. There's risk staying where you are. I mean, that's clearly illuminated by, you know, you think about the changes that have occurred in the last years, JLT rolling into Marsh, the Willis Aon situation. So I think that we often say to the clients, you know, we made our decision. We have arrived here. We're going to be here as a group of individuals working together, and therefore we offer stability.
Of course, we had COVID, massive, the biggest spanner in the works for many, many years for anybody. But of course, the biggest other bombshell that dropped after we put your podcast out last year was the Aon Willis announcement. I presume that has mostly been wind in your sails, hasn't it? That's been genuinely positive, I presume.
Yes. Look, I think it's gone on. There was speculation for a year, okay? So that prompted some activity in that period of uncertainty. And then it was announced shortly after we met. And here we are 14 months on in terms of that, and there's still a lot of uncertainty. So I think there's a lot of fatigue within those organisations, or I'm sure there is within individuals within those organisations. And so it would seem to me that they've lost control of the process to some extent. There's clearly a desire to get the deal done. The latest development creates some concerns around that, and clearly they've made significant concessions with the European Union in terms of the remedy package. So actually, in a lot of cases, the individuals there were sticky to wait and see what it was going to be like once the deal got closed. But that now seems to be further out. You know, the horizon has just extended again. And so we're monitoring that situation very carefully. And as I say, I think that there is a fatigue factor that's growing within those collective organisations, because they've been in limbo for a long time. And Marcel talked about stability, and we got to that particular answer as far as Peak is concerned quite quickly. And we hadn't really thought about it on the way in, about we've got people, colleagues, they've arrived from different places, many different places. We've got a purpose. We've got a vision. We're on a pathway and we want to build a great business. And so there's some stickability around that. Now, we're not taking any of that for granted, but I think there's shared goal and ambition for our business.
And I just think one other point, I mean, we do talk about being a talent-based business, but let's not forget the client ultimately makes the decision. And I think you've got to be thoughtful about disrupting clients by taking teams that doesn't necessarily suit every client, and therefore you can't necessarily expect that they're just going to say, well, thanks very much for hiring my team, you can have my business. I mean, clearly clients will evaluate their options, particularly the larger clients. They have choices as well. And so we have to balance all of this. And I think very often I find myself apologizing to prospective clients, because we have hired a key individual or a number of key individuals that have represented them in the previous employer, previous broker. And that's where we start our position, sort of very humbly, sorry for disrupting your delivery, but how can we help?
And I suppose the other phenomenon that Aon Willis, if it hadn't already happened with Marsh JLT, was if anybody had any ambition in aviation long term, it's flushed them out. Did you find it unleashed even more of a war for that talent, because it flushed out all sorts of people with ambitions in aviation who weren't there before?
For sure. I think, you know, dislocation and disruption creates opportunity. And I think so. I think everyone was looking at what the opportunistic boundary and framework looked like. I think that what's helpful for us at this point is we've got some proof points. So I think when we met, it was really around aspiration, but we've got some proof points at this point in time. And as Marcel said, you know, some very, very significant clients have made a decision, which we're really proud of in terms of what we've achieved, proud for our colleagues as well, because it's an endorsement to the decisions that 50 plus people have made to come here. I talk actually quite a bit, and Marcel and I have socialised this a fair bit, about what we have learned in this period as leaders and colleagues. And it, you know, it has been testing at times, 8 hours, 10 hours longer on video calls at the beginning of this, when, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty in the world. You know, there was a lot of uncertainty around whether or not something like this could work as effectively in that environment than a normal environment. And I suppose, as I said, we've got these proof points that give us a great foundation to build and grow, and some confidence as opposed to arrogance to build on that.
You've had some really big contract wins, the sort of clients, I'm not sure if we need to name them, but the sort of clients that you do associate absolutely with the big three. You say this is why the big three exist. They're here to serve clients of that ilk, global clients served by global brokers, and that's why they exist. So how did you manage to sort of start to dislodge some of those accounts and sort of deinstitutionalize them?
Well, I think, first of all, Mark, we obviously established quickly a relatively large team, and we talked about 30 people a year or so ago. We're now over 50 people. We've hired from some of the largest broking houses, and we've hired some exceptional talent. So with that, of course, we have introduced a level of disruption into some clients' teams because we've hired the very people that represented them in the past. And so perhaps there has been a reason for the client to consider what their options might be. On top of that, the aviation market has been somewhat harder in recent times in terms of prices increasing. So clients are obviously thoughtful about that, aligned to the fact that COVID is introducing financial pressures on the aviation industry. So in some respects, clients have got it on all fronts. And then, of course, in the broader market, we're seeing Aon, Willis, we've seen JLT Marsh, as we've talked about. So I think a number of clients were reaching the point where they were thinking about evaluating their options, going to tender. Many of those were deferred from last year because of the disruption introduced by COVID. But that said, we're seeing a significant increase now. So the number of client tenders this year will be three or four times what you might expect to see in a normal year. We're, of course, perfectly positioned at a time when clients need help the most for ideas, innovation, strategy, that our team has arrived. Well, obviously, when you start, you're not overly encumbered with legacy work. So we can put our very best people towards developing solutions for those clients. And I think that's been reflected in the number of major wins that we've had. I would say this, wouldn't I? None of them have come easily. I mean, we've worked hard to win those clients. We had no expectation, absolutely, of winning those clients until they made their decision. But I do think it's a reflection of the talent that we have and the concepts that we are able to deliver.
Just to add to that, we talk about having a differentiated client proposition. Well, anyone can say that. But I suspect, and we've had some feedback, in fact, that our offering is different. You know, we are looking to develop some partnerships with third-party partners to offer some different type of perspective, some different type of product, so that we can compete on the core mandatory type covers. We can do that in a sophisticated way as well, but we can also offer some things that others won't. So I think when we have responded to formal tenders, the feedback we've got is our responses have been a bit different to the rest of them, which is a good thing.
I think also another point is that we are a bespoke aviation client focused solution. We don't have to talk to a broader geography about what they think the response should be or to other product lines. We're making our own value based decision on how we engage with the client and how we respond. And clearly we operate in a highly regulated way. But in terms of style, branding, approach, we've used some really innovative ideas and those have clearly resonated with the clients.
I was going back to thinking about the first podcast we did where you said your experience of working in a very large broker, sometimes you just feel that aviation is sort of an afterthought and a rounding error, you described it as. Presumably, is this your USP to those clients to say you won't be a rounding error within our operation because you're core to our business? In fact, you know that if we win your business, it will move the dial for us and it will be significant and we'll be all punching the air.
Yeah, I think to answer it this way, Mark, I mean, I remember that comment we made a year ago. I think I said, you know, I had led one of the larger aviation businesses, but it was less than 1% of the revenues of that broking firm. They valued the client base that we looked after, but in terms of revenue and investment, you didn't necessarily move the dial. I think I've got a personal view that specialty businesses is much better served in a specialty broker because this is what we spend all of our time doing. We are a specialty business today and we'll be a specialty business tomorrow and part of a specialty business tomorrow. So that's very much the focus of the overall enterprise and that tends to focus the operations mind on what the clients need and how they are best served.
But you hinted this earlier, Phil. Obviously, Peak is part of the Corient Global Group. Probably this time last year, it was called BGC Insurance Partners. And there's obviously a deal now announced between Ardonagh, another big specialty group, and also a big UK retail group, How's that going to affect you? Often when I'm a journalist covering these sort of things, the first thing I would look for with a startup business or a business maybe that's been recently acquired would be to say, did you have some sort of clause, change of control clause, where you could float off into the ether and go and attach yourself to another platform or get another backer? So how's it changed your plans?
So I'm not going to comment on that last point, but the early exchange and dialogue with Ardonna has been positive. You know, it's an insurance business or insurance businesses. The investors are serial investors in the sector. It's a growth story. We're a growth story. And so what I would say is we feel really proud about our brand, actually, which had launched a few weeks before we spoke. But whereas I think in that phase, in the immediate aftermath of the brand launch, people were talking about, well, what Peak, what is it, why is it? It's a bit of a strange name. People are not talking about that anymore. I think we are recognized in the industry. We are a competitor, clearly a competitor in all sectors, large, medium and small. And so we're open-minded around the platform that Ardonna will provide, and we're optimistic about it.
And I think I could also add to that. I mean, two of our most recent wins, two very large and significant client wins, were made either the day of or in the days after Ardonna announced their planned acquisition of Corrent. So I think that's a validation on the part of the client side that they'd obviously, presumably, spoken to us, asked us what we thought about the scenario, and were willing and able to confirm their appointment of Peak as their broker. And so I think that speaks volumes for what the clients think and indeed what we feel about the opportunity.
So really, you're a growth-orientated startup. You had a growth-orientated backer. You're going to change from one growth-orientated backer to another, and hopefully you feel that nothing much should change otherwise.
Look, I think we've been treated as grown-up leaders in the business, in the wider business. And so, you know, we are taking that responsibility very seriously and have done. So when Marcel talks about 1%, as we were going on our journey, it was sort of more than 1% quite quickly. And the volatility around that is an added, you know, layer of responsibility. So I think that we came here to build a market-leading aviation and space broker. Nothing has changed from that. We're on a pathway. You know, there's more to follow. Undoubtedly, not every week will be as good as the week when we landed two major clients in a week. There'll be some bumps along the way. But when I look at the trajectory of the business, the colleague base that we've assembled, the tightness of the leadership group, you know, I'm really optimistic about the future.
Actually, just off the cuff, what does 50 employees as an aviation department, how does that compare to other aviation departments that are available?
The bigger ones are, you know, are more significant. They'd have additional infrastructure within that in all probability. And we've had very solid support from the Corrent group in terms of some of the core functions, the central service functions, in order to get us to where we are today.
I often ask people, what sort of entrepreneur are they? There are two types. One who wants to build a business and then realize the gain and have the excitement of putting a new idea into practice, being that sort of entrepreneur. Or there's a more driven sort of business builder who wants to build that business forever, almost to say it'll be Peak forever and I'll be taken out in a box and Peak will go on forever beyond me and I'll never really sell, if you see what I mean. What sort of entrepreneurs are you? You're sort of eyeing some exit point at 6 years time when you think I'll get my millions and then I can buy the yacht.
I'm not a sailor, so I'm not sure I'm buying a yacht.
Well, okay, private jet then, obviously.
So I'll answer from a personal perspective, and I'm sure Marcel's got his own view. So when we set this up, I kind of had this view around reshaping the industry or challenging the industry, and a new name would become prevalent in the industry. So from my own perspective, my personal ambition is to build a great business, a sustainable business, a market-leading business in partnership with Marcel, but the many colleagues that we have. And then at the right moment, hand it over to the next leadership, the next generation to take it on whatever journey. So it was never come in the entrepreneurial bit of come in, do it for a bit and then move on. Equally, I don't plan on being here forever. So there's, I think, the third version, the hybrid version, which is where I sit.
I think that, you know, whilst financial reward is important to many, I would suggest that most of our senior team that joined, including myself, have done this more for emotional opportunity. At the end of the day, many people could have perhaps been better off financially in the short term had they stayed where they were. And it's about creating something different. And again, I've got to go back to, there is a client involved here. We're building a business, attracting the very largest clients in the world. Whilst there are elements of our business that include wholesale, we're appealing to the sophisticated retail client. So I think that from their perspective, they want to know that we offer them stability, and that if they choose to move to Peak, that we're going to be around to the best of our knowledge or the best of our ability to service them, not just today, but tomorrow and into the future. Because retail clients tend not to chop and change every year. They often make decisions that last for years or indeed decades. And so I think that's an important parallel.
Yeah, I asked Clive Washburn about that, and he said it was ego, but he meant not ego in sort of, you know, egomaniac sort of sense, but more in that job satisfaction sense. So he's had a career, he probably doesn't have to prove anything to anyone.
Some of our competitors, and perhaps some of our former employees, did not believe that it would be possible to set up a bespoke boutique aviation business such as Peak and attract the sort of client base that we have. So maybe there is a bit of ego in there that we're now recognising that we wanted to prove that some of the brightest in the industry were in fact wrong in their assessment. And as Phil said, a year ago, people were sort of a bit curious about our name and what did that mean, and the odd joke here and there. I don't think people do that anymore. They've won another major account, or they've won two this week. What's next? And that really is, that's what's driving us. What is next in terms of our value proposition, and what can we offer the clients that's different to that we were able to deliver in our legacy firms?
It's interesting you mentioned about when you come to these tenders and you've got something different. What sort of things are we talking about? Is it just the fact that you're a small business and you can be quick in making decisions, or an experiment with, there's insurtechs, there's people with databases, there's all sorts of clever people you can talk to, and perhaps if you were a larger broker, it might have taken a bit more organising?
So I think it's a combination, yeah. Being small and nimble is an advantage, clearly. We've spent quite a bit of time and investment in building out an analytics platform, Peak IQ. We like the name. And so that's been an important component. But we've also partnered with a number of different firms across the industry looking at alternative products that I would say are not non-core, which in some instances have been particularly relevant given where the industry, the distressed element of the industry, the distressed state of the industry, and actually in some instances may take the conversation beyond risk management into treasury and, dare I say it, finance. And so if you're bringing those sort of conversations to bear and it's a relevant solution or product, that can be really impactful.
Well, also I think it's easy in a tender for a broker to overpromise and underdeliver. And by that point, you know, the broker's won the business. I mean, that is not our style. In fact, we would like to invert that to sort of underpromise and overdeliver. So it's about finding right balance. But it's interesting that some of the more recent wins we've had, the clients are actually talking to our prior wins to ask them for reference or feedback. And if our clients are willing to talk to other prospects and prospective clients, then, you know, we encourage that because the proof is in the pudding. So if the existing clients are happy with our delivery, we're obviously very keen for them to share that with our prospective client base and to increase our appeal.
It's time to talk about the aviation market itself. I've got two aviation experts. Well, can you run us through what's happening, obviously, because it's been crazy, the dynamics on supply, demand, the risk itself, COVID, aircraft being grounded, and then a wider hard market across the board coming on the back of some incredibly soft years in aviation. Walk us through it. Obviously, there's quite a lot of moving parts there.
It's a broad question, Mark. So why don't I take a stab, and I know Phil will add to it. I mean, obviously, we've got different components within the aviation market itself. We have the airlines, the manufacturers, the general aviation space, and indeed the satellite and space business. Clearly, the manufacturers and the airlines are aligned in some respects because those that manufacture the aerospace equipment will sell into the airline industry. And there's no doubt, I think we're all familiar with the tough times the aviation industry has had over the last year, the inability for us to travel, business, holiday, or whatever it might be. So clearly we saw the airlines in particular, and to some extent the manufacturers, looking for the support of insurers during these difficult times. Sales are down, revenues are down, passenger count is down, and of course exposure is down. So it's obviously been our challenge as brokers to illuminate that to the insurers, who indeed have their own issues in terms of the challenges COVID has brought them. So, I mean, ultimately we look at insurance as supply-demand market, and despite the fact that aviation premiums have been stabilizing and in fact increasing to some extent in recent years, every story is different. You know, has the client had significant losses? Has it had significant challenges? Are the exposures down materially? But I think we can say that all of the brokers have had robust conversations and discussions with the insurers themselves in terms of where the market's been going. I think the real issue for us is as airline exposures start to come back, I mean, I think we'd hope they would start to come back sooner and that we would all be flying and that revenues would be flowing. Clearly, we're not seeing as much of that as we had hoped, certainly here in the UK. The issue will be how does insurer rating hold up as exposure increases, as premium is generated by virtue of the rates that are applied. And again, I think it's going to depend on, you know, the mix of the airline, you know, long haul, short haul, again, their exposures, what their load factors look like. So it's going to be an interesting period for a few years, I think, as we see the impacts of COVID rolling out. We've seen a number of airlines sadly go out of business, but equally we've seen, I think, something like 75 new airlines already rise from the ashes. We're talking to a number of them. We've won a number of new airlines as they're looking to start up. So it's a dynamic business. I mean, notwithstanding the pressures that COVID have brought for all of us and, you know, perhaps stay vacation becoming more common, I think dynamically we all want to travel. We want to visit places we haven't been to. Business travel will come back. And so it really depends how that manifests itself. Aviation is much safer today than it was in prior decades through the innovations that the manufacturers and the airlines have collaborated on. So it's really somewhat linear to if there are losses, that has an impact. If there's increased exposure, that has an impact.
The insurance market, has it held up in terms of its appetite?
Yeah, look, I would say that this is a general statement. I think given that most of the airlines renew in the fourth quarter, as you well know, I think that the market generally tried to do the right thing by a distressed client base. Each individual account would have been negotiated separately, but I think they were trying to make the best accommodation they could in each case. Sustainability in terms of tenure is always interesting. You know, when's a hard market continue to not be as hard and go into the sort of firm category, or a complex market becomes a hard market? These are questions that we will ask and challenge, and the proof points will be dependent on major transactions which will shape the next several months, or indeed the renewal season as it comes on the airline at the back end of this year. So I think that, as Marcel said, the industry has become safer and therefore the risk should be better, and we haven't seen too many people pull out.
And in terms of that hardening, do you think, is it too soon to say you can see it coming to an end? In terms of price adequacy, it must be very difficult at the moment because of, presumably, you've got what we describe as frequency benefits in that, you know, exposure's completely down, planes are not flying around, they're parked, completely different risk. But losses presumably are down in aggregate, and underwriters, one presume, are making money. Do they feel now that with the years of increase that they've had, have they got the rate back to where they feel it should be technically?
So I think that what happened at the back end of last year was what I would call premium protection. They were basically trading the drop-off in exposure and not increasing the premium. So the rating went up quite significantly, and obviously each airline was different, but for airlines where the exposure had dropped off 30, 40, 50%, they were having not dissimilar rate increase on a like-for-like basis. So I think that, again, Marcel makes a really good distinction. I think long-haul exposure will look very different from domestic or regional. And then I think that inevitably there will be an element of competition because there is still oversupply in many cases. And you've also got some new entrants that are building up that will continue to try to evolve their business model as they grow and develop.
And pricing adequacy, I think, is in the eye of the beholder. And ultimately, you know, some insurers have inferred that 2020 could be one of their best years in recent years by virtue of the pricing stability, premium stability that Philip inferred, and the fact that losses were relatively light. The other issue, of course, is no insurer writes every risk. So it rather depends whether you were lucky or unlucky based on the losses that occurred last year. It was a low year in terms of fatalities, fortunately, but obviously attritional losses, hull claims all factor in. So I think we're generally, as Philip said, seeing oversupply in general terms. Obviously, there's always the odd risk that meets the exception, but in general terms, there's more supply, and so that's affecting the supply-demand curve.
And does the real proof of the pudding come when the exposure, the actual sort of passenger hours, when that comes back? So the underwriters have held the premium as expiring or whatever and had the benefit of the fact that planes were not flying around and the risk was much lower, so risk adjusted, they're doing well. Is the real proof when things come back and we won't know because things haven't come back yet. At that point, if they continue with a flat premium, then you know their risk-adjusted rate is going to be plummeting.
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, I think it's rated on projection for the next 12 months, and I think that that depends on the finance department's perspective of what the next 12 months looks like. I think that I've dealt with buyers who've been predominantly financed that have insurance as part of their responsibility. I'm sure they've been reforecasting very, very regularly over this period because it's been very volatile. I think when we went into lockdown, in fact, we presented internally to the investor about the expectation that come September things might change. But obviously we went into the autumn and the winter and it was pretty grim and not much changed. And there are signs of positivity. I think North American domestic travel has returned fairly robustly. And I think China domestically and obviously sort of regionally. But the holiday traffic is still slow. It's complicated. I haven't been on holiday overseas, but it's complicated and expensive from a process standpoint. So I think this is going to continue to slow. And of course, the summer months are incredibly important in the Northern Hemisphere for that holiday traffic.
Hey, look, I use myself as a poster child. I've done 2 business trips in the last month and I'm doing 2 more next week. So I think that perhaps I'm unusual at the moment in that regard, but I've got the appetite and the desire to travel, particularly from a business perspective. So let's hope as people become more fully vaccinated that appetite increases and that will only serve to support the aviation industry, which is a critical part of what we do.
Well, Phil, you mentioned about potential new market entrants into aviation. In the wider market, we've seen a phenomenon of the class of 2020, new capital being formed. Has any of that capital finding its way into aviation?
I've talked to one or two of the chief executives of the new entrants. I think they're watching carefully because of the dynamic within the industry of, okay, rates have gone up, but premium hasn't. And I guess when they're looking at it and, you know, effective use of capital, I guess when they're comparing it to some property casualty areas or, dare I say it, D&O, there's a more positive outlook. I think what will happen is as the passenger traffic increases, that will become more interesting for these new entrants at that point in time.
And what about reinsurance? Certainly, again, when I talk to everyone, the wider aggregate of the marketplace, reinsurance seems to have been quite a benign influence, that they've just been happy for it. Insurers have been putting the prices up, and that's the way the dynamics have gone. Reinsurers haven't been hardening the market. They've just been riding that hardening market and just benefiting from the better underlying rates. Is that a similar sort of picture in aviation?
Well, I think aviation reinsurance market has been distorted by a notable loss in 2019, which has one of the largest losses to the market ever. And clearly that is filtering all the way through to the reinsurance market. As we understand it, that is increasing pressure on reinsurance premiums. But to an extent, again, it's not a straightforward picture, as some larger insurers buy on a cross-class basis. They have the ability to flex. They have the ability to change their retentions. If certain insurers are increasing their premium writings, which we are seeing, then obviously that has effect on reinsurance rate and premium. So broadly, we understand reinsurance pricing is going up. As you yourself pointed out, reinsurance have made a significant profit over aviation reinsurers over time. So I think that they have to reflect, is this a short-term bubble for them? And in fact, could they drive, you know, the direct insurers to take more risk at a time when there's less exposure? So they've got to balance their own style and approach. And ultimately, we're not necessarily seeing that significantly feed through to direct pricing. Direct pricing seems to be very much more driven by exposure metrics and people assessing the business that they want to be involved with.
And obviously, that big loss, that's in the manufacturing space, one would assume. And again, so of reinsurers being the ultimate backstop for effectively a cat, almost systemic loss, because you're talking about such a very limited pool of manufacturers within aviation. Are they really driving change there? Is this almost like their pandemic?
No, I mean, you could say it's a one-off unusual loss that has occurred. You know, it's the largest that we've seen. We've seen that in other sectors of the insurance. If it was more systemic, repeated, then you might say, well, that's a reflection of where the market at. So, I mean, this is the point about insurance. I mean, it is for that is not expected. So what was the remediation around those? Some of the manufacturers' issues in particular are ongoing. The broader industry is regarded as hugely safe. I mean, I often say, you know, our manufacturer clients make the industry safer. Sometimes their products are called to question subsequently, but ultimately it is much safer today to fly as a passenger than it was a decade or two decades ago. So you have to sort of balance that in the round. But we are not seeing a reduced appetite for the manufacturing business. If anything, the manufacturers are regarded as stable, strong balance sheets, strong pipeline of sales, often sales going out multiple years. So it is a stable segment that is attractive to insurers in the long term.
Is there a lot more demand for information than there would have been?
Well, broadly, I think the manufacturers are very good at sharing information and educating insurers, and indeed, in some cases, reinsurers. In the past, I've visited with reinsurers with clients so that we can articulate and help them understand the underlying risk that they're assuming. I mean, ultimately, aviation industry is highly regulated, you know, by virtue of the various regulatory bodies that exist, and no manufacturer or airline seeks to operate a business that is unsafe. So we can rely on those two fundamentals. I mean, essentially, occasionally things happen, and I think lessons are learned. I mean, I think back to the past where we had incidents of wind shear. Now there is wind shear technology to predict it. You know, they had incidents of aircraft flying into terrain. Now there is technology to avoid that. So as the industry learns from each incident, it shares that knowledge amongst itself and then evolves to a better place. So I wouldn't like to suggest that, you know, think good things come out of bad things, but ultimately lessons are learnt each time there are significant incidents in our particular industry. And that serves us all better, both as insurance professionals and as passengers.
So there's no crisis of confidence in culture?
I mean, I can't speak for specific clients, but I would say broadly, there again is a recognition that it's a highly regulated business. There is also no such thing as a bad risk. It's just a question of what is the right premium for a risk. And I think that's how insurers are tending to assess things.
And there's no shortage of capital providers either, and capacity, which would be directly impacted by a loss of confidence. There'd be a shortage of capacity, and that hasn't manifested at all.
No one's running away. You've got a healthy market to be working with. I think I've come to the end of all my questions, Phil and Marcel. I just wanted to thank you for giving your time. Really looking forward to seeing this story unfold. Obviously, things are going very, very fast, and obviously it's been one hell of a year and so unexpected in so many different ways. You have certainly impressed me with what you've been able to achieve in such a short time. So I'm going to let you get back to doing all of that, and then make sure you check in with the Voice of Insurance at some point in the future.
Well, it's been a pleasure. It's great to see you, as I said earlier, and yeah, we'd be delighted at the right time to reconvene for the third leg.
Yeah, Mark, don't be a stranger. Come back anytime.
Thank you so much. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, don't forget to subscribe or leave a like or a review or recommendation on whatever podcast platform you used to access this programme. These really help get the word out. Before we go, just a quick reminder that advertising slots are available here and in other places in the Voice of Insurance podcasts. Podcasting is the fastest growing medium and attracts a high quality audience of key decision makers. It's also an intimate medium where you, the listener, are right in the room with me and the interview subjects. Needless to say, that means it's a great way of getting your message out directly to an audience because you know you've got their full attention. It's also very cost effective. So get in touch with Mark at thevoiceofinsurance.com to find out how you could be speaking directly to the industry.
The Voice of Insurance is produced in association with Advantage Go, enabling an enterprise view of exposure.
Voice of Insurance is produced by me, Mark Gagan. Music was written by Anna Gagan and produced by Carlos Gagan. Check out more podcasts and written comment pieces at www.thevoiceofinsurance.com.